Angela Davis, and more, go to democracynow.org. That does it for today's show. Democracy Now! Is produced by a remarkable team in the studios and sheltering at home. We want to thank each and every one of them. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Adriano Contreras, and Maria Tarasena. Our general manager is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Miriam Bernard, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Mike Burke, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, and Dennis McCormick. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us. Stay safe.
Boogie Cat. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM Community Radio.
Is your organization planning a virtual event? Looking for a media co-sponsorship? Then contact KBOO today. KBOO's community media co-sponsorships provide free on-air promos for local nonprofits and small organizations, as well as a listing on our website's community calendar and promotions on our social media. For more information and to apply, visit kboo.fm/co-sponsorships today.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a U.S. federal district judge has issued a restraining order to protect journalists from attacks by the Portland Police Bureau. The PPB declares the second riot in 3 days, and House Speaker Tina Kotek goes toe-to-toe with Portland Police Association President Daryl Turner. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, July 3rd, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. Last night, another confrontation erupted between demonstrators protesting police violence and the Portland Police Bureau. The protest started out peacefully with a couple hundred protesters outside the Justice Center, but according to police, late in the evening, some protesters broke into the building while others broke glass doors in the federal courthouse. They stated that protesters were throwing rocks, bottles, and full cans at officers. Just before midnight, police declared a riot and threatened the protesters with tear gas and crowd control munitions. When the crowd did not disperse, videos appear to show officers firing at the crowd. Protesters then move off, but returned at about 12:40, and at least one incendiary device was thrown into the federal courthouse, starting a small fire. Police again declared a riot and used both crowd control munitions and pepper spray. Police say that no tear gas was used, but they were seen setting off devices that emitted either smoke or gas. A federal court order has banned the use of tear gas by PPB unless they believe someone's life is in danger. This is the second time in 3 days that the Portland Police Bureau has declared that a protest developed into a riot. After Tuesday's confrontation, Oregon House Speaker Tina Kotek called the use of force by the PPB, quote, completely unacceptable, in an email to Mayor Ted Wheeler. State Senator Lou Frederick agreed. Portland Commissioner Joanne Hardesty has called on the Portland police to ban the use of tear gas under any circumstances and demanded charges against journalists covering the demonstrations be dropped. Over the more than 5 weeks of protests and civil disturbances in Portland, there have been numerous reports of police violence against journalists. In one instance, video taken from a K2 News helicopter showed a freelance journalist as he was chased by a PPB officer and repeatedly pepper sprayed. Other journalists have been detained, arrested, and had their equipment confiscated. On Sunday, the ACLU sued the Portland Police Bureau, claiming that the PPB was targeting and attacking journalists. A U.S. district judge has now issued a restraining order. With more on the story, here's KBOO's Lisa Loving.
Over the past month, at least one dozen Portland-area journalists have reported being beaten, tear-gassed, or arrested by the police during incidents of civil unrest. The list includes journalists employed by The Oregonian, Willamette Week, The Guardian newspaper, and others. A U.S. district judge ruled last night that journalists with, quote, professional or authorized press passes and legal observers will be exempt from Portland police orders requiring protesters to disperse during declared unlawful assemblies or riots under a 14-day order, The Oregonian reported today. Further, the ruling says police cannot threaten, arrest, or use force against a person, quote, who they know or reasonably should know is a journalist or legal observer, and officers are prohibited from confiscating cameras, audio, video equipment, or press passes unless they have probable cause to believe a crime has been committed. In a related story, City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty Wednesday called on new Chief of Police Chuck Lavelle to immediately drop all charges against reporters who were arrested while covering protests. She also demanded the city stop use of tear gas and munitions against protesters, as well as rubber bullets and LRAD sonic weapon attacks. I'm Lisa Loving, KBOO News.
The president of the Portland Police Association asked why State House Speaker Tina Kotek did not express outrage about vandalism from protesters in North Portland on Tuesday night. In a Facebook post, the president of the police union, Daryl Turner, criticized Kotek's response to the clash between protesters and police. Kotek lives in North Portland and was there when the police fired tear gas and other crowd control devices into the crowd. She sent an email to Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler, where she called the actions by police, quote, completely unacceptable. She also stated that the protesters, quote, posed no risk to the public until the police declared an unlawful assembly and started tear-gassing the crowd. Kotek wrote, quote, what needed to be protected last night? An empty office building? Was this more important than the health of neighbors, of children in a neighborhood, of people returning home from work? Turner responded to Kotek, noting that he and another union member were inside their union office when protesters gathered there. Turner said some demonstrators threw rocks, frozen water bottles, and fireworks at the officers and stressed that his personal safety was important, as was the safety of small businesses in the area. Kotek has yet to respond, but the back and forth comes during multiple legal battles about police conduct around journalists and protesters, as well as the special legislative session called by the governor to address police brutality. 2 weeks ago, Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler suggested that city workers take paid time off to grieve for the deaths of Black people killed by police officers. And in that time, 20% of the Portland Police Bureau has taken advantage of the policy. According to a report in The Oregonian, 249 Police Bureau employees have requested time off for bereavement leave. That's more than half of all the city employees that have used the paid day off. The second highest percentage of users came from the Bureau of Emergency Communications, that's the city's 911 dispatchers, with 18% of those employees taking the bereavement leave. Initially, an email from the city's human resource office said the leave was aimed at Black employees and other employees of color, as well as white employees who have immediate relatives who are people of color. It went on to ask white employees to reflect on reasons why they would consider taking the time, and how they can support their colleagues who are Black, Indigenous, or people of color. Current data shows overall the city's workforce is 73.5% white, and that 82% of PPB employees are white. 46 Bureau employees identify as Black, and 224 identify as people of color. Portland does not track why employees request bereavement leave and does not have demographic information on those who took the leave. The mayor of Estacada, Oregon, is facing calls to resign after making a statement on social media saying he did not condone Black Lives Matter. Mayor Sean Drinkwine wrote, quote, "As your mayor of Estacada, I would not and have not condoned these BLM vigils in our community. All city staff and I are working tirelessly to shut these vigils down. Our number one concern is to keep our city safe and free from conflict." At a city council meeting on Monday, Drinkwine apologized for the comment, saying he was a bad writer and meant to address concerns about violence accompanying protests. That hasn't satisfied his critics. The Portland NAACP is calling for Mayor Drinkwine's resignation, saying his explanation isn't enough. They've planned a march from Portland to Estacada on July 17th to demonstrate against the mayor. For many Black families in Oregon, food insecurity was an issue even before the pandemic hit, but a Corbett-based small farm and food enterprise is taking action. For more, here's Eric Tegedoff with the Oregon News Service.
As the COVID-19 pandemic grinds on, some organizations are leading efforts to provide relief to Black Oregon families. Shantae Johnson co-manages Mudbone Grown, a Black-owned farm that hosts programs for community members. The farm is heading the Black COVID-19 response team, providing food through a community-supported agriculture model to 50 Black families. She says food insecurity was an issue for many of these households before COVID-19.
The pandemic really just highlighted the inequalities that people are currently experiencing and have experienced for many generations.
Mudbone Grown is partnering with the Multnomah County Health Department's Racial and Ethnic Approaches to Community Health Program and the organization Beyond Black. With funding from Oregon Food Bank, the response team also is providing families with household items. In order to eliminate food insecurity, Johnson says the social determinants of health must be addressed, including race.
There's no one singular issue. It's all intersected with one another. And so the more we look at trying to address the root cause, I think the better off we'll be.
Johnson adds that it's important to support Black farmers with access to resources and infrastructure. And most importantly, folks need to listen to Black community members.
Trust Black leadership and don't try to co-opt things, but come from a place of understanding and then match that support with funding.
The Black COVID-19 Response Team program is in its second of 8 weeks. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Oregon City Commissioners unanimously passed a vote of no confidence against Mayor Dan Holliday. The commissioners cited a few reasons for the no confidence vote, namely that Holliday threatened to defy the governor's stay-at-home order, he violated city policy by soliciting private donations for fireworks, and for his comments on social media about Black Lives Matter. The vote of no confidence is a formal way for the commissioners to show that they don't trust the mayor to govern the city. The commissioners called his actions detrimental, and they said they have, quote, led to a loss of faith in his ability to effectively lead the community and the commission. Holliday's comments on social media about Black Lives Matter were described as dismissive and lacking in compassion for the Black community. At a meeting Wednesday, the city commission president said they would hire a third-party investigator to look into Holliday's misdoings. Holliday faces calls to resign and a potential recall effort by locals to force the mayor out of office. On Tuesday, Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler and Parks and Recreation Director Adina Long said they are looking for city council approval to place an operating tax levy on the November general election ballot. The $220 million levy would allow the city to restart recreational activities in city parks by next summer and end the department's reliance on fees to improve park access and maintenance. The city park system has been hit especially hard by the restrictions imposed as a result of the coronavirus. In an email, Wheeler and Long stated that the parks will remain closed this summer due to the COVID-19 pandemic and consequently are not collecting fees for things like swimming lessons, exercise classes, rental permits, and other revenue generators. Those fees fund over 40% of the Parks Bureau's recreational budget. Portland maintains 150 parks and 12,000 acres of land in and around the city. If passed, the proposed levy would cost the average residential property owner about $130 a year. The park levy is one of at least four ballot measures that will be put to Portland voters in November. Under Oregon rules, unemployment recipients do not receive benefits for their first week off the job. This has historically been called the waiting week, but at the start of the pandemic, Oregon Governor Kate Brown ordered the Oregon Employment Department to begin paying recipients for that week. Unfortunately, Oregonians are still waiting. And when asked about it, OED Director David Gersonfield could only say when the missing payments would be made. The delay means that, for many, they may be owed as much as $1,000 when the basic unemployment benefit is combined with the extra $600. According to Gerstenfield, the waiting week is firmly embedded in the state's outdated computer system, and that bypassing the system could put applicants' future payments at risk. In a statement, Gerstenfield said, quote, "There are automatic checks and balances that have been built in to stop people from being overpaid that would automatically stop any future benefits from going out," end quote. He went on to say that suggested workarounds have failed. The employment department is only in the early stages of modernizing its system and has not been able to say when the waiting week payments would be made. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast at 5:30, we're going to hear Counterspin. At 6, it's Let's Talk About Race. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight, we'll see a cloudy evening with an overnight low in the high 50s. For the 4th, we can expect a partly cloudy and mild day with temperatures in the low 70s. On this date in 1863, the Battle of Gettysburg ended in a victory for Union forces. It was seen as the turning point in the Civil War. Today's quote is from President Abraham Lincoln, who said, quote, "Whenever I hear anyone arguing for slavery, I feel a strong impulse to see it tried on him personally." Over the last couple of weeks, President Trump's responses to the many crises enveloping the U.S. has continued to undermine his favorable rating and has even begun to erode his base. KBOO's Ray Bodwell has these thoughts.
If this was baseball, President Trump would have been called out on strikes over the last couple of weeks. Let's start with his comments about the disastrous Tulsa rally, where he continued to extol the great job he's done in controlling the COVID-19 pandemic and called into question the validity of coronavirus testing.
"I saved hundreds of thousands of lives. We don't ever get even a mention. We've tested now 25 million people. When you do testing to that extent, you're going to find more people. You're going to find more cases. So I said to my people, slow the testing down, please."
Since his visit, Tulsa County has seen the highest rate of new infections among all of Oklahoma's 77 counties. And yesterday, over 55,000 new cases were reported nationwide, continuing the trend of a new record high every day. And then there was a New York Times story that the president had ignored a security briefing report that Russia was paying a bounty to Taliban fighters to kill American soldiers in Afghanistan. Despite a bipartisan call for an explanation, the president shrugged off the reports.
"From what I hear, and I hear it pretty good, the intelligence people didn't believe it happened at all. I think it's a hoax."
Although there is a question about whether he was verbally briefed about the CIA's concerns, there is no question that it was included in the daily security briefing that evidently he doesn't read and still continues to shrug off. And finally, in response to the continued nationwide uprising over the murder of George Floyd by officers of the Minneapolis Police Department and the outpouring of support for the Black Lives Matter movement nationwide, the only thing he can do is complain about the fact that the words "Black Lives Matter" will be painted on the, quote, fabled and beautiful Fifth Avenue right in front of his cherished Trump Tower and Tiffany's. His latest mouthpiece, Kayleigh McEnany, followed that up with this classic.
"He's talking about the organization. I would note to you that the Greater New York BLM president has said, if this country doesn't give us what we want, that we will burn down the system, and I could be speaking literally. I'd call that a pretty hateful statement."
If nothing else, it proved once again that fact-checking is not a forte in this administration. The individual that McEnany attributes the quote to is in no way connected to the official Black Lives Matter movement. Many of us are hoping that we will see the end of this national nightmare on November 3rd, and the latest numbers give us hope. Joe Biden has taken a lead in many of the battleground states, and the latest polling data on the website 538 shows that Trump's disapproval rating has hit nearly 56%, while his approval rating has sunk to 40.7. Unfortunately, the question that brings to my mind is, what would Trump have to do to earn the disapproval of that 40%? It's a terrifying thought. For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
President Trump is visiting Mount Rushmore today, where 7,500 people are expected to hear him speak and witness a fireworks display. But due to concerns about wildfires and water pollution, fireworks have been outlawed in the area for 10 years. With that story and more, here's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
Those are colonizers' faces, you know, carved into our sacred lands, our sacred mountains, what is known as the Black Hills and Mount Rushmore. You know, to the Lakota Dakota people, it's Pahasapa.
Mount Rushmore was known to the Lakota Sioux as Pahasapa or Heysapa, the six grandfathers, long before Americans first carved it up in 1927. Jordan Marie brings three white horses. Daniel is from the Kulbi Chasoyate or Lower Brule Sioux tribe in South Dakota. Indigenous activists are protesting President Donald Trump's July 4th event at Mount Rushmore today. Laura Tenfingers of the Oglala Lakota tribe is an organizer.
The timing of this is really inappropriate, especially to the vulnerable population that we have here on our reservation.
Seven South Dakota tribes objected to the visit to no avail. Native reservations have been hit especially hard by COVID-19, and the Cheyenne River Sioux tribe is suing government officials for ordering the closing of highway checkpoints set up to slow the spread of the virus. The event includes an elaborate fireworks display, despite concerns over wildfires and groundwater pollution that have kept fireworks out of South Dakota's Black Hills for 10 years. Here's Ten Fingers again.
We're going to be spreading our message and bringing attention to the desecration of sacred sites here in America, and to basically show the state of South Dakota and whoever else is paying attention that the actions and ideologies of the Trump administration aren't welcome here.
O.J. Simmons runs Four Directions, a Native American voting rights group. He wants a lot more people to pay attention.
What we want to make sure is that we do whatever we can to increase the Native turnout so that regardless of who wins the election, the Native vote will be heard.
The pandemic has complicated, already challenging voter registration efforts on reservations, where more than half of residents with computers lack access to high-speed internet.
The way we've done it all these years, Four Directions, we don't send a bunch of people into reservations. We'll send one or two people there. When we hire people, they're already going to be within those communities they already live. And we're going to be hiring them for them to make contact with their family and friends, which they're already doing.
Preparing early to vote is key during this pandemic, says David Becker from the Center for Election Innovation Research. Their data shows April registrations down 70% compared to the same month in 2016.
Presidential election is the time where you're getting the most people involved, likely to vote. You're getting the most infrequent voters participating, people who might not be really well versed in the process. And getting them registered early is the key to getting them information so they can vote in safety and convenience.
Presidential campaign donations haven't slowed. This last quarter, former Vice President Joe Biden outpaced the Trump campaign $282 million to $266 million. And 200-plus George W. Bush administration alumni launched another super PAC in support of Biden, saying, quote, democracy is at stake. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
The rise of fast fashion is increasing the carbon footprint of the apparel industry. For more on that, here's Dr. Anthony Lizowitz with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. When you shop for new clothes, you're probably not thinking about the climate. But making apparel creates carbon pollution, and the industry's emissions are on the rise as people buy and discard their clothes more frequently. The problem is made worse by the rise of fast fashion, clothes that are cheap to make and cheap to buy. But Chen-Din Yen of the World Resources Institute says apparel companies are starting to take climate action.
Many companies globally are setting targets and then really trying very hard to reach those targets.
Yen co-authored a paper that can guide the industry. She says the biggest challenge is that clothing brands often outsource manufacturing to companies in other countries. Those companies may rely on others for raw materials, which makes it hard to measure and reduce carbon pollution.
So what a lot of these brands are doing is to educate and engage these suppliers. I think that's what we want to see, and we're seeing more and more.
For example, Levi Strauss helps its suppliers obtain low-interest loans for renewable energy or efficiency projects. And Nike is helping manufacturers switch from fossil fuels to solar and biomass. Yen says as more suppliers get involved, it will help reduce carbon pollution throughout the industry. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
Unrest in the city of Minneapolis halted food deliveries to elders. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A Native chef helped organize deliveries to elders amid COVID-19 in the Minneapolis area, but that was stalled due to unrest in the city, as Rhonda Lavaldo reports.
With the stay-at-home orders in place in Minneapolis, many Native elders relied on Brian Yazzie, Navajo, to get daily fresh meals. But then with the death of George Floyd and riots that took place, that daily meal had to stop for 2 weeks.
So we end up switching our daily meals to serving grocery bags twice a week. So we have detergent, we have bar soap, you know, we have shampoo, hygiene products, we have face masks, and then non-perishable items like canned beans, canned vegetables, and some frozen meat that we also put into the grocery bags.
Vanessa Casillas, Ho-Chunk, and a volunteer, said her previous job experience helped figure out when they couldn't do daily meals and shifted to grocery distributions.
My background is actually in construction, so I'm used to working on a job site. I'm used to things always changing, and you have to adapt and flow with it. So this really isn't too far out of, I mean, yes, I've never lived through a pandemic before, and I would say no riots either. So those two things, really, we just had to become fluid and adapt.
Head chef of the Minneapolis American Indian Center, Ben Shendo, James Cochiti, talked about how their role is mainly to get food to elders who may not see anyone during the day.
But we know during that lunchtime, when they open the box, they got something that can, you know, really bring them joy. And some of the stuff that you can see has been donated, also has been going with them. You know, crossword puzzle, hygiene kits, you know, coloring, just stuff to kind of keep the morale up. And some of these elders who came to the center and the others that were feeding, some of them are living by themselves. You know, some of them don't have, you know, too much interaction. Maybe coming here to the center was it. So that also makes me think about, you know, that extra love, extra care.
The daily meals that go out, as Yazzie explained, are 50% indigenous items to provide comfort food for those Native elders. This is Rhonda Lavaldo for National Native News.
The Rosebud Sioux Tribe in South Dakota wants to create the largest Native American-owned and managed bison herd in North America. Seth Tupper of South Dakota Public Broadcasting has more.
Wizipon Little Elk has a big vision for bison on the Rosebud Reservation. He wants to build a herd of 1,500 animals and a processing facility to provide food and economic development for tribal members. He says now is a perfect time for the project. The COVID-19 outbreaks at packing plants and meat shortages in stores have consumers looking for different ways to get their food.
I think that what has happened with the coronavirus pandemic is that the world has told us that our work is not only important, but that it is urgent.
Little Elk is CEO of the Rosebud Economic Development Corporation. With help from the World Wildlife Fund, the corporation plans to convert cattle pastures on the reservation to a bison range of 40 square miles. The development corporation will get excess bison from the Interior Department, which manages a number of herds, including those in national parks. Little Elk says the grass-fed bison will be killed and slaughtered humanely.
Basically, what that means is treating buffalo like buffalo and not treating them like cattle.
First, they'll replace cattle fences with bigger, sturdier fences for bison. The first animals are scheduled for delivery this fall. For National Native News, I'm Seth Tupper in Rapid City, South Dakota.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, June 3rd, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast is Lisa Loving, Ray Bodwell, and Althea Billings. The producer is Ray Bodwell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Antonia Gonzalez, and Eric Tegadoff. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programming, including the evening news, is made possible with help from our listeners. If you'd like to support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for Counterspin.
James Chassie, a gentle soul who lived with schizophrenia, was well known in Portland as a writer, artist, and musician. In 2006, James was brutally killed by Portland police. He committed no crime, yet he was tackled, beat, kicked, and tased. He later died in police custody. The police officers who killed James Chassie were never held accountable. Join us on Prison Pipeline, July 6th, at 6:30 p.m. as we remember James Chassie.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson.